You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
Welcome to the ECF staff room. I'm Elaine Long.
And I am Mark Quinn.
We are programme leaders for the UCL Early Career Teacher Development Programme. Why are we in the staff room? We are here because this is where the best professional learning conversations always take place. This is where problems can be aired bluntly and where solutions can be explored.
Over the course of this series, we will hear the voices of different colleagues as they come into the ECF staff room. We will hear from early career teachers themselves and from the mentors and induction tutors who support them. We will talk about all things ECF, the challenges and the joys. So why don't you enjoy a coffee with us, perhaps even grab a biscuit and sit down to half an hour of ECF staff room chat. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ECF staff room. And actually, thank you, Melanie. Melanie has invited us into her office or her staff room for the day, if you like. So she's invited us to put our feet up and take our coffee. We've had a lovely walk around your school, so we might get to talk a little bit about that later on. But we always ask our guests how they take their coffee or how they take what's their drink of choice. I see you've got a Diet Coke in front of you.
I'm afraid it's Diet Coke all the time for me.
Very controversial.
Yeah.
That gets you through the day, does it?
It does. Everybody else has their tea and coffee, but I always have a Diet Coke. I'm actually known now when I go into any meetings, they'll always say, "Where's your Diet Coke?" So, yeah, keeps me going.
Well, we're feeling very cozy here with our mug of coffee. It's a real coffee rather than a virtual coffee. Usually we just manage to get virtual coffees out of these podcasts. But thanks for inviting us in, Melanie. We're going to learn lots about your role in Castlebar Special School. And we're looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, and I also share your addiction to Diet Coke as well, Melanie, so you're not alone. I think you probably have need for all that caffeine, having seen how busy you are here. It's been a real privilege to walk around with you this morning, and I wonder if you can just introduce yourself for the listeners, because I know they'll be interested in your journey into education and particularly what brought you into special needs education.
I've been in Castlebar a long time now. I mean, I'm going to say 22 years. And I originally started in mainstream. And once I'd finished at St Mary's University, I was teaching in mainstream schools in London. But I always had a passion for special education. I always wanted to work with children with additional needs. And then it came to a point, I think with me, I get to a point every 4 or 5 years where I'd like to try something different, or I need something else as a challenge. And there was one year in Hammersmith when I worked in Hammersmith that I had a group of children and there were a lot of additional needs in the class, and it really made me think about teaching and what it was all about and how to support them. So from there I decided I was going to move into special, and I came to Castlebar. Big shock as a mainstream teacher.
I'm straight to Castlebar.
Straight into Castlebar. And the children at that time had moderate learning difficulties. But even with moderate learning difficulties, it was such a big change from the mainstream. And it took a while, but I was really invested in it and stuck with it. And I remember the deputy at the time saying to me, "If you're not interested in working with children with complex needs, don't take this job." So I knew there were going to be changes ahead. But the school has always been really invested in training and development, lots of CPD opportunities. And I suddenly realised, you know, how much there was to learn, and I loved it. So I took every opportunity that was given to me. People in the school were very supportive. So any ideas I had, they went with, so which was great. And then I went up the ranks, as you'd say, through the years. I was the cluster leader in charge of a team of three. Then I went up to assistant head. And then I always said I'll never be a deputy and I'll never be a head. And I always said that, and people remind me of that now. But at one point then, I became very interested in the teaching school alliances. Right. And with the head here, we discussed it. And he said, well, if you really want to do it, then you can do the application. You go forward and take the school into this position. So I had a lot of support from the head, from the local authority, from the business manager who worked beside me. And we did the application and we became a teaching school. So at the beginning of being a deputy in the school, one of the main roles for me was actually the teaching school, although I still had my duties here in school. So I had to really balance that. And that was tricky because you were getting pulled at both sides. But what it did do was gave me a really outward facing perspective. And I enjoyed that. So I met a lot of new people. I learned a lot of new skills, and particularly around finance. We just talked earlier, didn't we? It's horrible asking people for money. But I was in that position where I couldn't say, oh, no, we'll just do it. We had to ask for the financial backing for all of these things that were happening. So for the six, seven years, it was all about mainly the teaching school, but also the duties in school. And I could be in a strange position of like giving out the dinners at lunchtime at one point, and then the next minute I could be in a meeting with the local authority about, something around SEN in the borough or delivering training. So I was kind of zipping between things, but it all seemed to work. And then just at the end, a couple of years ago now, the teaching school alliances were finished because we were moving into that new phase with the teaching school hubs. Mm-hmm. So my work in the teaching school alliance was finishing. But that's exactly when all the work around the ECF was going on. And I was kind of really interested in that because I'm always keen on the training and development for our staff here at Castle Bar. And that's one of my main duties here now at the moment is CPD and curriculum. And so I was interested. I wanted to know what it was all about. Nobody really understood it at the beginning, and it was having to kind of research it, see what was going on. And then, of course, it was about, well, how does SEN fit into this? Because it didn't look like we had a place in it. And then I spoke to other colleagues, and they had the same concerns and the same kind of thoughts. How are we going to go forward with this? And I contacted some of the main providers, UCL, yourselves being one of them. And actually UCL were the first ones that came back and said, we want to look at something for SEN. It's important. And my other colleague and myself were very interested in this. And obviously then we worked together.
Yeah.
But in terms of the school now and me as a deputy in the school, because I think your job changes so much anyway, because different things happen in a school. Somebody might leave. Who's going to do those duties? Lots of things change the whole time. But currently, my main priorities in the school would be the curriculum, CPD, working with the middle leaders, supporting them on their studies and journeys. We've got a couple of people here doing the MPQSL apprenticeship and an MPQML, and I work with them and support them. I'm their mentor. And then working with teaching assistants, upskilling teaching assistants. I deliver a lot of training in the school, or I have a group of people with so much expertise that I can ask them to do the training. And our middle leaders have a curriculum area that they lead on. So I tap into their expertise.
So you've got middle leaders leading professional development as well throughout the school.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've even got teaching assistants who have got expertise in particular areas, and they will lead. Just last week we did a food technology session, and it was me and one of our HLTAs that delivered that session. So we're all about learning here. People are very keen to learn There's always something to learn. It's never standing still in Castlebar. There's always something new. And then, of course, in the day-to-day, it's greeting the children in the morning, because, of course, the children are the most important part of the school. So I would greet the children in the morning, bring them into school, take them to their classes, checking that everybody's in. I have to look at the attendance. And I do that with the team, because there's a team of us that do all this. The assistant heads that work with me, we all look at the attendance. And then it's following up safeguarding issues, because obviously a lot of our children are coming on buses. So we need to be very vigilant. You know, little bruises or a child's upset, we'd need to check that straight away. Mm-hmm. So we work as a team in the morning, and a lot of those sort of things would come up in the morning. And then throughout the day, it's amazing how busy the diary gets, with lots of different things going on. It might be observations, it might be supporting in a class for a certain amount of time. It might be involved in a meeting with the multidisciplinary team, because we have a large team of multidisciplinary workers here. So we've got occupational therapists, speech and language therapists. And again, that group of people work with me. So I work with them, have meetings every half term, every 2 weeks with the leads. And then also meeting with the leads of those professions outside of the school as well. So it's very busy. And no day is the same. No day is the same.
No, and we should be, we are very pleased you let us in on your busy day today, Melanie. Actually, that's a tour de force of a career. You've just yeah. Actually, I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to rewind you a little bit back those 22 years. Mm-hmm. And I have just a question about that experience you had in mainstream.
Yeah.
And what you remember of it, but more particularly, have you taken anything from that experience into your work in special school?
That's an interesting one, because when I first left St Mary's, although I was interested in teaching, I wasn't completely taken up with teaching. So anything could have happened in the first year. Anything could have happened. But actually, I was very lucky to get a job in a school in Kilburn. And that is where the love of teaching for me started. And I think it's a lot about teamwork. It's a lot about working with people that are also have the same outlook as yourself for the children.
Right.
And so that's where my kind of love of the teaching started. And what I would take from mainstream, I suppose, when I was in mainstream, again, around behaviours and things with children, you know, what was going on for the children? That's what I kind of would be always interested in. And I met a lot of children there where there were things going on for them at home that were influencing behaviours in school. So I think you start to kind of develop practices that are more empathetic, really. Yeah. About what's going on for the child. And then that just got stronger when I left mainstream, but I brought that from mainstream with me.
Well, that's interesting. I think either you do or you don't develop that empathy.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me you were lucky, I guess, to fall in that school in Kilburn with others who shared that vision or shared that outlook that you had, because that isn't always the case, is it?
No.
Sometimes. And I suppose that would have helped you develop that sense of empathy you have for that. You began to look at what was behind the child's behaviour in class and stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can see that would be. It's always an important thing to remember, and have a culture around you of other colleagues that can support you is really important as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's nice to remember, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, it's a two-way street here with people. We do have teachers moving in from mainstream into special and back the other way. That does happen across our profession.
And I've met a lot of Senkos. I've worked with a lot of Senkos in the last few years in mainstream schools, and I've done peer reviews with them.
Okay.
And it's so interesting to see their investment in children with special educational needs as well, and that has been really powerful. So actually working now in a mainstream school and seeing how committed people are to support the children and see the barriers that are in their ways, and but they're still trying to overcome them. So there are people in mainstream, and I think it was like that for me when I was there myself teaching, that have that real investment in those children, and they will go the full mile and try to, you know, cross those barriers to support them. Yeah, and the families, obviously.
Absolutely. ECF, let's talk about that for a little bit. Last year, or was it the year before even, Melanie, you were part of a very small team that we were lucky enough to gather together to help us develop the supplementary resources for our programme for those teachers working in special settings, special school settings. I'm interested in why you think it was important to do that. Why do teachers in such a setting need those very specialised resources?
I think looking back, and this was probably when I was part of the teacher school as well, I think we were always looking, weren't we, for that sort of pathway so that students would lead into their new teacher training, and that would take them forward into middle and lead, you know, and senior leadership. And they wanted that pathway. I think we were always looking for it, but we never got there. Mm. But the ECF and the core content has kind of started that, and has brought it in, hasn't it? And it leads into the MPQs, which have all developed. So I think we're almost, we've got it there now, which is brilliant, which is what I think people have been looking for a long time. I think it's great. And I know it will be, things have to be reviewed, because there'll always be glitches along the way, but at least there is that sort of framework in place. So in terms of the ECF, obviously we didn't know where we sat because we were special. So I think it was important, because also I think it's important for special school teachers to see that they've been recognised in any of these new initiatives, because sometimes it does feel like we're not, you know, that we always have to pick up the pieces and do something ourselves. And that can happen even in a, you know, in a local authority, where the special schools might sit slightly separately, or whereas actually we should be all together. It's just a different side of education, isn't it? So so that was important to us, that the teachers felt that that programme belonged to special schools as much as it was for mainstream. But also, if you've got to, it's quite an intense programme. So if you've got to meet with your mentor every week, then what you're discussing has got to be relevant.
Yeah.
And that's why we were so invested in getting involved in this. So the colleague I worked with, we did our best to add resources in for that first year of the ECT. And we added as many resources as we could, or tweaked the slightly adapted things. But we couldn't do it for every module because it was just very, very different. But looking back now, I'm almost thinking that even having a general resources of special for special that we've done, that may not be the best way forward. I actually think, because we've got an ECT here ourselves this year, I almost feel like it's easier for the school themselves to adapt as they go along, because they, you know, all special schools are not the same.
Yes.
So it's, you can make it relevant, but you put the work in yourself for the ECT.
And if schools knew that they had the license to do that, if they felt that they were allowed to do that,
I think they'd feel more comfortable, you know. And I have to say, because it's the second year now and I'm working with the mentors, at that first mentor meeting, I think there was a lot more feeling of comfort in the second year, because it's more about the research and it's more about the practice in the classroom. Mm. And I think everybody agreed that they liked the second year, that it was more applicable for us. And obviously we've got a great investment in lesson study.
Yes.
And which really does help when you're moving into that year two.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so.
Could you take that inquiry approach already?
Yes, yeah. So I felt very comfortable with that. So when I had the meeting with the mentors, I felt really comfortable, because whenever you do a training session, I think you've got to know what you're talking about. If you're not invested in this, then it's going to be a flop. But so it felt very, I felt at ease doing that session because of it's about research and inquiry. And I was able to share some of the resources that we use here in Castlebar as an example. I said to them, don't just use what we've done. You know, it's got to be you changing things, but it gives you an idea of what has worked for us.
I think this leads very, very nicely on to my next question, actually, because you mentioned that a love of learning is really important to you. And I can see here that as well as fostering a love of learning in the students, it's really important that you foster a love of learning for adults in this building. In many ways, everybody's learning and it's a community, and we share those values and ambitions for ECTs on our programme. And one of our high quality outcomes or things that we hope for our ECTs is they also value professional learning. We want to teach them that through the programme. And you've already hit on the sort of nub of that if they're going to value it, it has to speak to them. And you've already sort of talked about the sense of inquiry, but I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more about some of the conditions that you think lead to ECTs really valuing their learning
In a special school.
And I think also some of those lessons will apply more generally as well, certainly in a special school.
So in a special school, I mean, as I said earlier, as we were walking around, if you come into a special school to teach, you feel like an ECT anyway. If you've come from the mainstream or wherever you've come from, because every special school is different. So when we have new teachers or ECTs, they start on the induction programme. And so we are supporting them along the way. We all know that if you just do a one-off training session, it doesn't stick with people. It doesn't mean that it's going to change the world, but it might, because some people might like that and they pick it up. So the way we kind of train our teachers here, maybe some of the time they don't even realise they're learning things. But we have a multidisciplinary team, and they do a facilitation role. So they actually go into the classrooms and they teach the staff in the classrooms how to deliver programs, interventions, and they'll work with, say, one teaching assistant, and they'll show them how to use the program, the intervention. Then they step away, but they just revisit to check that it's all working well. And that works very well. We have so we're not kind of always putting pressure on the staff that they've got to be at this training session, they've got to be at that training session, but they get support with everything that they do in the school that's new. So, for example, if they have to write an IEP, the first one is always written with either their cluster leader or their mentor, or it's written with a senior leader if we need to step in, because we step in for everything if we're needed. If they do a progress meeting, the first one is always set up and done with their mentor, cluster leader. So they don't probably even realise that they're actually learning the skill, and that they're getting the knowledge of what they have to do and assessing children, but they learn it through those kind of pathways. The other thing we do is drop-ins. So our middle leaders will often do a drop-in about a particular intervention. So for example, if I said to you it's about blanks, then they might do a blanks drop-in, and any teacher in the school or teaching assistant who thinks they need to know about that, they will do a drop-in. So they're all invested, because if they don't get invested in that learning, then they won't be able to provide the best practice in the classroom, and they want to do the best practice.
So it's about continual professional learning in the truest sense of the word. And you mentioned drop-ins and that being an open door culture. And one in which people don't feel frightened about actually, but people embrace learning. I know that some teachers in the early stages of their career might be quite scared of people dropping into their classroom. How do you sort of avoid that happening?
I mean, I suppose what we do, and you can say things and say things, it doesn't mean that somebody's going to believe it, but we always promote the fact that everyone's there to support. And that if you do a drop into a classroom, it is about support. We do a formal observation in the autumn term for everybody, but that's really just for us to get a chance to go into the classrooms. We run it like lesson study because everybody is invested in lesson study because it makes people more at ease, because it's about the learning and it's about the planning.
Yeah.
So what we've done with our formal observations is that we have that, we have a pre-meeting with the teacher and we talk through the planning for the lesson. The teacher talks us through and we can ask questions and we can say, well, what about that? Have you thought that? Or, you know, so we just, it's a natural conversation. For some newer teachers in the past, it's made them rethink something and then they've gone back and thought it again before presenting the lesson. But sometimes there's no need for that because most of the time our teachers, you know, are very organised and they know their children so well that they've covered all the bases for us. But what it does do for us when we go into the classroom is that then we don't need to kind of think, oh, why is this happening? Because we've already had that information. So it really helps. And then the feedback at the end in the second part of that whole organisation, they talk us through again. And then it's suggestions and considerations when we talk, rather than you need to do this, this needs to change. That's not the way we work, really.
Which links back to sort of that inquiry approach, which is kind of really feeds through everything you do in the school. And you mentioned mentoring as well, because obviously on the ECT programme, ECT spend a great deal of time with their mentors. And in your experience, because I know you facilitated sessions with mentors as well, what do the best mentors do to support their ECTs?
Well, I think the best mentors are the ones that are really invested and they're invested in developing others. And I know from the groups that I've spoken with how much time they put into this work. And they are prepared when they meet their ECTs and they spend that time with them. And I think that's what you need. This year we've got an ECT and I've got feedback from her mentor, and her mentor would say that sometimes it's quite hard to, you know, to kind of really focus on, you know, what you've got to go through because there are so many other things going on. And it's finding the time to really sit. But what she has done, which works well, is that every meeting is in the diary. So if it's in the diary, it means it's going to happen. Whereas if you say, I'll make that meeting, I'll arrange it for the next 2 weeks, that won't happen. It's got to be in the diary. And she's also flexible. And I think the other mentors that I've spoken with as well, I mean, if that ECT's had a really bad day, you don't plough ahead.
No.
You have to think about, you know, the situation that you're in, and you need to react and respond to what you're hearing, really. And if you can do that, that's great. If you're just focused on, I'm going to get you through this programme and this is what you've got to do, this isn't right, you've got to do this, that won't work. It'll destroy everybody, won't it?
I think that's really useful advice because feedback we've had is that a lot of our mentors struggle with balancing getting through the knowledge elements of the programme and getting through the learning intentions and then balancing that with the emotional needs of ECTs, which of course we know that schools are really challenging places, and I would entirely agree with you that they have to use their judgment there about what to talk about and when, and it's not a rule book or a script to follow. It's a guidebook, so I think that sort of approach is really useful for mentors to think about.
You have to remember that the ECT has an agenda,
yes,
and the mentor needs to listen to that agenda. That could be what's happening at that moment or what's been happening that week for the ECT, as well as what they're moving on to and the structure of the program as well. And it's interesting, I think, that's the sort of language you were using when you're describing your formal lesson observation. Actually, you're handing the agenda to the teacher, and that kind of talk me through what you're planning to do, and then after the lesson, talk me through how that went. And that's most of the talking in a lesson observation feedback should be the teacher, rather than the person who observed. I think that's if you want to, if you really want to make it developmental. And I think the same in a mentor meeting. You know, what needs to be talked about right now. That's and that insight you have, I'm sure you, I can imagine, Melanie, when you're facilitating your mentor cluster on our program, that you can draw upon many examples of those interactions you've had while working at Castlebar. I'm wondering, thinking about that facilitation that you do for us on the program, how would you say that the mentor development program has, actually has been useful to those mentors, and what would make it more useful?
So I think it's definitely been useful. I think they would say it's been useful to them, that they've learned a lot from it. And in terms of making it more useful, the actual session itself, are we thinking?
The session, your facilitation of the session, how you meet, where you meet, any of that really.
I mean, I think we kind of know that we couldn't do it face to face, but it would be better. It would be better to have a group that met face to face, but because we're all over the place, really, it just wouldn't work. But
We're in a very large
teaching
school hub area here in Teach West London. Yes. Actually, so I think it's the largest, perhaps. Mm. And so obviously your teachers are going to be well dispersed across the area as well.
Yeah. So geographically, and some of them are up in Northumberland.
Ah, so yes, that's
because having, we're special.
Yeah.
So
definitely not possible.
And I think so. It wouldn't be cost effective to do it like that. So it's easier to be online. But there's the limitations of online, because people are waiting, aren't they? You never know whether you can speak or and also the time. I mean, it's an hour. I can remember last year one session where there were a few things that came up, and it was about how hard it was, you know, meeting ECTs. This was quite early on. And there were a few things we wanted to talk about and talk it through. And I think we managed to, but it felt very quick. Because the hour was very quick online. I mean, an hour just goes so quickly. I did wonder whether an hour and a half would be more realistic, because if you really want to get into some of the conversations and discussion, but then at other times people don't want to get into the, you know, there isn't anything to go deeply into. It was just that one session last year. I kind of felt I'd like to carry on and delve a bit more with this. And a lot of people were giving advice, and we were really talking through a problem that had come up. But I was very conscious that I had to stick to that time.
Yeah.
Maybe if there was a flexibility that it was an hour to an hour and a half, then you could actually judge as you went on if there was something that you wanted to explore a little further.
Mm-hmm.
But it's people's time.
Yeah.
And so you have to be very conscious of that.
Yeah, quite. It is a balance, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how have you found it's changed? Because I know you've done your first session for the year two of the programme.
Yeah.
Have you seen a change in those mentors as they come into the second year of the programme? Or
much more confidence. Well, definitely greater confidence. And they are enjoying it. They will say that it can be hard at times because things come up in schools, like, you know, absence, etc., which kind of makes it harder for them to do their meetings, or they have to rearrange. But they are positive about the program. But I think a lot of them would say what I'm saying in terms of for special, that there's a lot more needed. They still, those ECTs in special are not just doing the ECT program. They've got to do another program of induction that's been set up by their school, because otherwise they would sink. If they were just relying on the ECF program as it is, that would not enable them to be the best teacher they can in their specialist setting, because they need so much more.
And that must be hard workload wise.
Yes. But, and our teacher here now, she's managing. But she would say that sometimes it's hard because she's got a lot of other commitments as well. And like the multidisciplinary team are working very closely with her. But if they want to meet her in the morning, she wants to meet them because it's going to be important for her class. But then she, at the other end of the day, she's got a meeting with her mentor for ECF. So it can make a lot of input for her that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you've got to keep an eye on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's good that our mentor is very, very experienced, the mentor who's with her here, and keeps an eye on that.
The flexibility is hugely important in supporting that well-being of the ECT in your school. Can I just ask, because I know you're very experienced in developing others and preparing for facilitated sessions, and you're very conscious that teachers are incredibly time poor, so what's in those sessions has got to be grippingly relevant for them. How do you go about preparing for your sessions then to make sure that's the case?
So is sessions for the UCF? Well, I look at all the materials that I'm supposed to look at. So I do that.
Do your homework.
I do my homework beforehand.
That's very good.
And then I suppose I just think about then what it is that I could share from my own experience, if there's anything. And I might not share that because it might not come up in the meeting. So I'm just kind of flexible on that. But I know that there are certain things I could share and offer. So I will do. And then I think you just respond to what you get from the rest of the group, because things come up. And then, I just go with whatever comes up then.
So you're very much sort of facilitating the session around the needs of the participants.
But I also like the other participants also. So if somebody brings something up that they want to talk about, I don't want to be the person who's just giving the answer. I do like to involve everybody and see what their point of view is, or have they got a good way of dealing with the issue that's been brought up.
And that's sometimes difficult in sessions, isn't it? To get people to talk and to get people to almost answer their problems. It's almost the nirvana of facilitating. Yeah. How would you do that?
Don't know, really. I mean, I just put it out there. Maybe it's just that the group are, they are quite responsive. And a couple in particular, there's a few really experienced people on there, which really helps and supports. And if people don't talk to me at all, which I mean, you can often get on online training. I might say the person's name and just say, would you like to share?
Okay.
Would you like to share something?
So there's probably, you're being quite modest about it, but there's probably something in there about the culture that you create from the beginning in terms of the session and people contributing.
Yeah, well, possibly, hopefully. but people do contribute. And so, I mean, some people might have a day where they don't really want to contribute. Mm. They're just having a bit of a day like that. And that's fine. Mm. But I would always invite people to speak. And I think it's important that everybody's opinion is valued within the group.
And the point of those online learning communities for mentors, is to be kind of discursive. It's not meant to be, right now, sit down, listen to the wisdom of Melanie Hogan, even though there's plenty of wisdom that you could share.
I could listen to the Melanie Hogan for a long time, I think.
Yeah, we all could, but as you're right to point out, there's lots of the mentors who will be in that session with you are themselves highly experienced.
Some
will be more experienced, some will be less experienced, but you've got to value that as well, don't you?
Yeah.
And it does lead me to ask this, is there, what is there about the experience or the knowledge that exists within, within special needs education, that those who are not in special needs education, those who maybe teach in mainstream, can learn from? I'm going to push you, if you can think of, three things, three nuggets. Melanie Hogan nuggets.
Oh my goodness. I don't know about that.
That the rest of the world needs to know about. What would they be?
Well, I think because we do a lot of outreach from here.
Yeah.
So and particularly recently, schools have got a lot more complex pupils in their schools. So we've been getting a lot of requests to go and support. I think it's useful for others to come in and visit, because then they see whatever we're saying, they see it in practice is always better. But particularly around, say, managing behaviours in a positive way, I think that's always useful. And it's looking at things in a different way. I've heard people say in a mainstream school, and I don't criticize them for this, because it's a different situation with a large group of children, mm-hmm. and they are under extreme pressure when they've got difficult behaviors that they're not used to.
Yeah.
But they can't do that. We mustn't do that. You know, they're not allowed to do that here. And of course, they're not allowed to do it here. But it's not going to stop because you say you're not allowed to do that here. Don't do it. It's not going to stop. That's not going to stop a child from doing those things, because for some of those children, it's finding an approach, get behind the behaviour. What's it all about? But then it might be about using something like motivators. And for in mainstream schools, I think for some people, if you suggest things like using a motivator, something he likes to do this, that you've got to get away from that thing like you're rewarding him
mm-hmm.
for the bad behaviour. And it's not that. It's not. It's
about changing. It's about giving a better choice.
Giving a better choice and changing the behaviour. Mm-hmm. Because what will happen is once the child is relaxed and confident in you, trust you, that they will probably then, the motivator is needed less often because they're enjoying what they should be doing and they've changed their routine. That habit of behaving in a particular way is gone because you've changed it by doing a particular strategy. So I think around behaviours particularly, and I suppose now it is about more about the actual learning, because they're having to adapt, you know, the curriculum so much in mainstream schools to meet the needs of the children that they've got, because some of them are nowhere near working at the level that they're expected to be in their year group. So it is about looking at the learning and how you adapt it. Do you use symbolised text? You know, and then, of course, you've always got to remember it in mainstream. What's hard for them if it's a year six or year five child is making it age appropriate, because if they're in year six and year five, rightly so, they're thinking this child would benefit more from a reception or a year one curriculum. But then if you've got to make it age appropriate,
the child's still 10.
Absolutely.
You know, not yeah. six.
So I suppose that's the sort of thing that we would be, it's a natural to us because we have those situations. So I think if anybody was looking for.
So it does make me think that, you obviously facilitate a cluster of mentors, all of whom we teach in yeah. special school situations. Should we not do that? Should we entirely mix this thing up? We shouldn't have in our program ECTs working in an ECT cluster and mainstream working in a mainstream cluster. We should
bring them all together.
Or is that just fantasy I'm talking?
No, I mean, I think it's a good idea in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we ran the MPQs here a few years ago, we mixed everybody up together. So yeah. when we had it in Ealing and we were doing MPQ, ML or SL, the specials and the secondary and the primary, they were all in one group.
Yeah.
So it can work and people benefit and learn from each other, don't they?
Yeah.
Different experiences together. So it's not, I don't think it's completely unacceptable to do that.
But we go back to your Kilburn experience. Yeah. You know, as long as you're amongst people with a similar outlook and a similar vision, then it doesn't matter what setting they're in. They're all willing to learn from each other.
Yeah, because you adapt, don't you? Mm-hmm. I've had to go in and observe in a secondary school. I've never taught in a secondary school in my life. But you're still able to do it because you know what good practice is and good teaching and learning, don't you?
I bet you could.
I've never taught in a secondary.
But I think it's interesting because I think you learn so much from visiting other settings, and it's actually a feature of our programme in the second year that our ECTs go out and visit other settings, and we think that experience as well is hugely important for professional development, because you learn so much about your own practice from looking at other settings as well. We're coming to the end of the podcast, and we know your time is precious and we've already taken up too much of your precious time, but one of the traditions of our podcast is that we pass you a post-it note, so here you are. And on that post-it note, we would like you to write down some advice, and it can be anything you want for anyone, but we'd like you to tell us what you would write on yours and who you would pass it to.
I suppose, and this is hard because I haven't thought about this really, but I think it's just about being open to opportunities, maybe. And if you're interested in something, don't think, I can't do it. If you want to do it, put yourself forward, no matter how hard it is. I've had lots of situations over the years where I've just thought, I'm going to run away from this. I don't want to do it. But actually, if you do it, the more you do these things, then the easier they become. So I think my advice would be that wherever you start, whether you start in mainstream, special, just be open to opportunities and take them. Yeah. And just remember that it's always learning. You know, you never know everything. You know, you don't know everything. You're always able to learn something new.
I think that's a great place to end. And we've almost come full circle from where we started, which was about you describing a love of learning. I think always learning is a really great place to end on.
Indeed. Melanie, thank you so much for allowing us into your very special, special school. And for making us nice coffee that we could drink through our meeting today. Enjoy the rest of your day. We've got to make our own way home after this. But thank you so much, and see you around.
And thank you.
Our thanks go to our colleague Melanie Hogan for sharing coffee with us this week in the ECF staff room. Melanie is deputy head teacher at Castlebar Special School, Ealing, and a facilitator on our ECF programme.
Please do get in touch with us if you would like to talk to us about your ECF experience. We especially want to hear from a range of voices. And lastly, we hope you'll join us next time for a biscuit and a chat with another colleague in the ECF staff room.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.